Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Having recalled his life through the story of the physical self in Winter Journal, novelist Paul Auster now remembers the experience of his development from within through the encounters of his interior self with the outer world in Report from the Interior. Paul Auster is the best-selling author of Sunset Park, Invisible, The Brooklyn Follies, The Book of Illusions, and The New York Trilogy, among many other works. It's a great pleasure to welcome Paul Auster to this week's book show. Thank you very much for being with us. A delight to have you here.
Nice to be here.
What did you want to do when you started to write memoir? Was it always your idea to do kind of interior, exterior?
No, things develop as they develop. There was no master plan. But the fact is, even though I've spent most of my life concentrating on writing fiction, this turns out to be the fifth autobiographical book that I've published, starting with The Invention of Solitude all the way back in 1982. And then there was the curious book about money or the lack of money called Hand to Mouth.
Right.
That was in the 90s. In around 2000, I published a small book with new directions called The Red Notebook, which is a collection of true stories that are mostly about things that have happened to me. And then after a pause, Winter Journal last year, which seemed to have generated this new book. This is a kind of, I would say, a brother or a sister to Winter Journal. The two books belong together. If you notice, the cover of Winter Journal had a very beautiful X across the front.
Yes.
And this one has a nice big circle across the front. So they belong together.
So it is a bit of a tic-tac-toe, then.
Well, I suppose.
When you think about that report from the interior and the fact that it's told in the second person, that was a conscious decision that you made at the very beginning?
Well, you see, Winter Journal was written that way, and it seemed to me very important to use that. I know it's very unusual to write a nonfiction work in that second person mode. But certain novels have been done that way, of course, but I don't know of any autobiographical work. But I think the point for me was this. I'm not terribly interested in myself. I don't find my life terribly interesting either. It's a normal life. It's a life that most of us have had. And by distancing myself from myself with the you, I'm able to examine it in a more objective way, as if to say, well, this happened to me, but I don't really own it. And this is a way of sharing life experiences with the reader. And the you somehow implicates the reader in the story as well. So I thought establishing that in Winter Journal, it made sense to continue that way of doing it for the new book.
And you do away with the word I, so you don't have to say, I did this, I did that. And it's as if that reporter, if you will, is almost reporting, yes, to us, the audience, but to you as well.
Yes, exactly. There's a certain distancing so that in a way I can enter into an intimate dialogue with myself as I'm writing, rather than just declaring, as you say, I did this, I did that, I thought this, I said that. I think it creates a kind of interiority that is exactly the kind of tone I was looking for.
When you say a brother or sister to the other book, you are covering in some ways the same ground, yet different ground.
Yes, yes. And in fact, it could have been possible to put it all in one bigger volume. But it hadn't occurred to me. I wrote Winter Journal thinking, well, that's that. And then I realized there was more I wanted to say. I had unleashed something, and I wasn't quite finished. And so this book, of course, is set up differently. Winter Journal is just one long rush with no breaks, no chapters, no nothing. This book is divided into four parts, and they're all quite distinct from one another. The first part, which is called Report from the Interior, is about 100 pages long, and it deals with inner development up to the age of 12. I really wanted to explore childhood and the way you think as a child, as far as I could remember it. I mean, nearly everything is lost. But the few things that I've managed to retain are the subject of that first thing. Then the next part is a close examination and description of two films that I saw when I was very young that made an enormous impression on me and changed my thinking about the world. That chapter is called Two Blows to the Head. Now, originally I was going to integrate that into the main text of the first part, but it was too long. I was simply writing too much. I thought, all right, I'll put that in another section. And then, astonishingly enough, not long after I started writing the book, I got a telephone call from my ex-wife, my first wife, Lydia Davis, also a writer and a translator. And we haven't lived together in, well, 35 years now, but we were kids together. And we met when we were 19 years old, and we had an early marriage that didn't last very long. And Lydia told me that she was gathering up her papers to give to a library. And among the things she wanted to give were the letters I had sent to her. And she informed me that she had over 500 pages of letters. Wow. This really bowled me over. I had no idea. More than 100 letters, totaling about 500 pages. So the thing is that in the case of letters, the actual piece of paper belongs to the recipient, but the words belong to the person who wrote the letter. So she technically and legally needed my permission in order to give them to the library and allow people to look at them. So I had to look them over. And as I looked them over, she would send them to me in bits, you know, 30, 40 pages in manila envelopes that came over the course of the months I was writing the first part of the book. And so I discovered a total stranger, especially the early letters from the first two or three years, the 19, the 20, 21-year-old boy writing. And it was such a revelation to me. So much had been forgotten that I decided to make a third part based on the material in those letters. Not the personal stuff between me and Lydia, but the things I was reading, the things I was going through. Because remember, we're talking about 1966, 67, 68.
A lot going on.
It was a time of tremendous tumult, and I was a student at Columbia University. This was the time when the university had its revolution, the explosion of that time, the Vietnam War, and the Newark riots. You know, I'm from Newark, New Jersey, and the Six-Day War. So it's all part of this third part. Then, the fourth part, which I call album, is a collection of photographs, not personal photographs, but it's a kind of recapitulation of the book through images. And so the things I write about in the first three parts are then illustrated. And for me, it gave a kind of balance to the book because the second part is about films, images, and then the fourth part is images as well. So it's got to be one of the nuttiest things I've ever done. It's a book, I don't know how to think about it. I don't know how to discuss it. I can just simply describe it, and that's it. That's what it is.
Paul Auster is our guest on the book show this week. The name of the book, Report from the Interior. I do want to talk about some of the parts of the book, and you mentioned when you were talking about the first part, which is Report from the Interior, that all was lost. And you write, actually later on in the book, you write, you thought you had left no traces. All the stories and poems you wrote in your boyhood and adolescence have vanished. No more than a few photographs exist of you from your early childhood to your mid-30s. Nearly everything you did and said and thought when you were young has been forgotten. And even if there are many things that you remember, there are more, 1,000 times more, that you do not. Did writing that first part help almost absorbed the shock of getting the letters and reading more about yourself?
Yes, it was. Well, you see, these things were happening simultaneously. I was writing the first part as I was reading all these letters that were coming in. So I was living in two time zones of my own life simultaneously, which was also a very strange thing. Actually, three, because I was living in the present as well. So I was in my early childhood, I was in my early adulthood, and I was in my advanced age all at the same time.
Which, knowing that this wasn't done consciously, makes the whole idea of a report from the interior makes it all the more sensible, because it's as if you're reporting to yourself.
Yes, yes, yes. I agree.
I'm hoping you can read a little bit from the start.
Yeah, if I read maybe the first couple of paragraphs, get some sense of, or I could skip around a bit. But here's how the book begins. In the beginning, everything was alive. The smallest objects were endowed with beating hearts, and even the clouds had names. Scissors could walk. Telephones and teapots were first cousins. Eyes and eyeglasses were brothers. The face of the clock was a human face. Each pea in your bowl had a different personality. And the grill on the front of your parents' car was a grinning mouth with many teeth. Pens were airships. Coins were flying saucers. The branches of trees were arms. Stones could think. And God was everywhere. Then there's a break. There was no problem in believing that the man in the moon was an actual man. You could see his face looking down at you from the night sky, and without question it was the face of a man. Little matter that this man had no body. He was still a man as far as you were concerned, and the possibility that there might be a contradiction in all this never once entered your thoughts. At the same time, it seemed perfectly credible that a cow could jump over the moon, and that a dish could run away with a spoon. And just one more, I'll skip to page 3. The world was, of course, flat. When someone tried to explain to you that the Earth was a sphere, a planet orbiting the sun with 8 other planets and something called a solar system, you couldn't grasp what the older boy was saying. If the Earth was round, then everyone below the equator would fall off, since it was inconceivable that a person could live his life upside down. The older boy tried to explain the concept of gravity to you, but that was beyond your grasp as well. You imagined millions of people plunging headlong through the darkness of an infinite, all-devouring night. If the Earth was indeed round, you said to yourself, then the only safe place to be was the North Pole. So this is it, you know, starting from these early, almost animistic experiences of the world, the kind of free-floating, nutty imagination of the tiny child, it develops into a discussion of a growing intelligence. First reading experiences, for example, and also discusses things such as America. The junk that they fed us in the 1950s about American history, how perfect America was, how there was no other country in the history of the human race that was more glorious and wonderful than the United States. And, you know, the slow discovery as a boy of the injustices in this country, you know, slavery, the treatment of black people in the 20th century, the extermination of the Indians, all these things, you know, slowly became understood as I got older. On top of that, then, the fact of being Jewish. I mean, when did I really understand that I was a Jew, in addition to being American? Did I discover my Jewishness before my Americanness, or was it simultaneous? I'm not exactly sure. But then there's a whole discourse on this growing awareness of what it meant to be someone who was very much brought up as an American. who felt very attached to this country, and at the same time, the dawning understanding that, well, even though I was a part of it, I was a little to the side of it as well. I was here, but not fully here. Accepted, but not totally accepted. And so these are some of the things that that first part treats.
You talk in that first part about, and this then jumping to the second part, but you almost, books are not a big part of your household, but you discovered them almost on your own.
Yes, yes. It's strange. Neither one of my parents was a reader. Neither one went to college. But from a very early age, I was in love with books. And I used to go to the public library in my little New Jersey town frequently, get books out of there and read. There's something that I don't discuss in this book, but I've talked about it elsewhere. The remarkable thing is that my mother's sister was married to a man named Alan Mandelbaum. And Alan, my uncle by marriage, was, well, probably the most brilliant literary intelligence I've ever known. He's famous for having translated Dante's Inferno, the Aeneid by Virgil, the Odyssey by Homer, the Metamorphoses by Ovid, in addition to translations of numerous contemporary Italian poets, his own poetry, and he was a professor. One of these Wunderkinds who got a PhD by the time he was 21. And he was my mentor when I was starting to write as a teenager. But for most of my young life, he was gone, living in Europe. He got a Fulbright and he left, and he stayed away for 11 or 12 years. Well, he left his books with us. And at some point, when I was about 11, my mother said to me, you know, we have all of Uncle Alan's books up in the attic. I mean, why don't we take them down and put them on shelves so we can let them breathe? Well, we did it, and we let the books breathe, and suddenly I had a library of all the classics right there in the house. Mm-hmm. And that was indispensable to my growth as a reader and as a person who was falling madly in love with literature.
And also film was very important.
Yes.
And as you said in the section Two Blows to the Head, you write about The Incredible Shrinking Man and I Am a Fugitive from a Chain Gang. Do you know what it is about those two films? Were they the ones that immediately rose to the surface?
Yes, it was without question that those were the two that I wanted to talk about. The first one, that science fiction movie, I saw when I was 10. And it was an astonishing experience. I suddenly felt I had a new opening onto ways of thinking about the cosmos that had never been available to me before. And the second one, which I saw when I was 14, was one of the great exposés of injustice, I think, that's ever been made in an American film. And it had an enormous impact on me. I don't know if you've seen either one of those films.
I have seen the first one. I have seen Incredible Shrinking Man.
Well, see, I Am a Fugitive from a Chain Gang because it is an extraordinary piece of work. 1932, Paul Muni as in the lead, Mervyn LeRoy was about 25 or 6 years old when he directed it. It was it's quite an amazing work based on a true story, by the way.
And I assume you viewed them again as you were writing this?
Oh, yes, of course, of course. I could never have remembered them as accurately as if I hadn't gone back and looked at them pretty carefully.
And there's images from the, from
yes,
the films
in
the book.
Yes, in the photo section at the back, yes, there's stills from the movies.
And finally, that brings us to the letters. Going through these letters and ultimately, that time capsule that you write about, this is a period of time. You're 19, from 19 to 22, it's 1966 to 1969. And as you say, a period of great tumult. So in looking at those letters, you're obviously following in some ways the same theme that you had established at the beginning of the book, but you are older.
I'm older now, yes, yes. Well, by jumping, it gave me a chance to avoid that whole crazy time of early adolescence, which is another subject altogether that I really wasn't interested in exploring as much as this, the early childhood and then the early adulthood. So, yes, I agree.
What was the nature of the letters in the sense of why you were writing in the first place?
Well, needless to say, each time I wrote, the two of us were apart. And so the bulk of the letters were written during 67, 68, when Lydia took a year off from college and was living in London with her sister, her half-sister. And I had started the year as a junior year abroad student in Paris, got into an enormous dispute with the head of the program, quit college for a little while, was talked into going back, particularly by my uncle, Alan, because of the draft and my deep opposition to the war. And I went back to New York, and a wonderfully compassionate, intelligent Dean Platt, let me back in midway through the first semester. And so I was writing to her from Paris and New York for, I think it's for 14 months. And I missed her a lot. And I really poured myself out to her. And so that's I would say that's 75 to 80% of the letters are from that year.
And if there is, of the great conflict in the book, much of it comes from Alan, you and Alan, in writing about him and what was going on.
Conflict?
Well, not as far as your as far as what was going on, arguments that were going on.
I don't understand. With Alan?
Well, with your uncle about, yeah, about the war and so forth?
No, he was he was completely on my side politically. He just was worried that I was doing one of the stupidest things I could possibly do, exposing myself to all kinds of miseries that I that were not necessary. And he was right. I was being very impulsive. And once I calmed down, I realized that I had made a terrible mistake. And he helped me.
Work it through.
Yeah, exactly. But we never really were in conflict. No. That would be exaggeration.
In writing about that, though, you're almost trying to work through it in the letters.
Yes. Well, I know one day I say, when the draft comes, I'm going to go to Canada. And then a week later I say, no, Canada, I'm going to go to jail. I'm so disgusted. I'll go all the way and put myself on the line about it. So it's difficult to recapture the insanity of that period in America, and particularly in New York at that time, the absolute desolation of Morningside Heights in Manhattan, where Columbia was, the place was falling apart. There were crazy people just wandering dirty streets, talking to themselves. Drugs were rampant. The city was very dangerous and violent. And then the war was on. And, we were living in a state of continual protests all during those years. And, the boys of that time, what did they have to look forward to? Okay, if you're a great supporter of the war, fine, you get yourself drafted and fight. But to tell you the truth, I didn't know anybody who felt that. I mean, the entire school was anti-war. So our options were prison or exile. Those were about the two possibilities if we refused to enlist or join the army.
This is an amazing book, and it's so beautifully written. It is entitled Report from the Interior. It is published by Henry Holt. Paul Auster, thank you so much for sharing with us.
Thanks for having me.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org. And you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. The show was recorded at Argo Studios in New York City. My thanks to their team. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.